You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll check in on the Milwaukee Brewers now that we're halfway through the 2019 season. First, Dr. Jasmine Zapata is trying to fix the way girls see themselves. Dr. Zapata is a UW Health pediatrician and assistant professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and she's traveling the country motivating young people as part of the movement she started called Beyond Beautiful. Dr. Zapata, welcome to Central Time.
Yes, I'm so excited to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, start us off with this message you are spreading. You take it on the road. What is the message of Beyond Beautiful?
Yes, Beyond Beautiful means you are more than what people see on the outside. Your true beauty is within, and that's the message that we give.
And what is the problem you see out there that led you to want to tackle this?
Oh, so many things that I've seen. But just briefly, I'll tell you a couple quick pearls. My daughter was born a 25-weeker premature baby. I was due January 2nd. I had her September 20th at only 1.5 pounds. So she was in the ICU for 3 months, had many life-saving surgeries that she needed. And I'm blessed that she survived. But when she was about 5 or 6 years old, she started getting teased at school for some of her scars that she had from surgery. And I'll never forget, she came home really discouraged and defeated, just talking about how her scars make her ugly. And I told her, your scars make you beautiful. It represents all that you've been through. And so I talked to her about the message, your true beauty is not on the outside, but it's what's within. So that's just one story of what got me started with this.
Big picture, do we get a message that hey, this is what beauty is? This is it, everything else isn't it?
Exactly. When you look at newspapers, when you look at the media, there's so many images of what beauty truly is, and it's really impacting a lot of young women.
Talk about the negative impacts for someone like your daughter.
Yes.
with scars or women of color sometimes who what's portrayed as beautiful.
Exactly. I was just doing a sleepover with my daughter and a couple friends, and one of the young girls was African American, and she was talking about getting bullied at school and being teased a lot. And one of the things that came up was that she felt ugly in her skin. She said being black made her feel ugly and not beautiful. And to hear that, that's just heartbreaking.
How old are we talking?
She was about 10 years old.
And already she's got that message.
Already, that's the message. Mm-hmm.
How early do we need to start talking to kids about this stuff?
We need to start talking to kids about this as soon as they can start talking in their toddler years. The strategy that we use is called positive youth development. Positive youth development is an evidence-based strategy to help young people feel empowered and become successful in life. And what it is instead of focusing on all that's happened in their past or the things that are wrong, you focus on what strengths do they have, and you really do everything that you can to just uplift and bring out those strengths and really foster those things.
I want to talk more about what you do in your talks and your
yes.
programs, but I want to take it back to that moment.
Yeah.
A parent in that situation, you hear
yes.
this from a 10-year-old kid who feels ugly in their skin.
Yes.
What do you do? What do you say?
Yeah. I just acknowledge that feeling, saying, I'm so sorry that you feel like that, but I'm here to tell you that you are beautiful. You're beautiful on the outside. I love your hair. I love your eyelashes. I love your skin. It's so beautiful. But most importantly, that's not what defines you. What defines you is those things on the inside that people can't see. You're courageous. You're resilient. You're confident. You're talented. All of those inner treasures, that's what matters most. And why this is so important is because those seeds of feeling negative inside or not feeling beautiful within, those are seeds that lead to depression and suicidal thoughts. And I, as a physician in my training, I've seen that a lot. Young girls coming in with suicidal thoughts or suicide attempts.
As a parent of teenagers now, I feel like if I were to say something like that to my kids, there's a lot of eye rolling going on. As kids get older, how do you still communicate that message, but in a way they're not just going to be like, yeah,
yes.
whatever, parent?
Good question. So it's so important to have innovative strategies that can deliver this message. So that's why I started the Beyond Beautiful movement. It's not just conversations. What I've done is I've partnered with performing artists. I have turned the Beyond Beautiful book into a song. So I actually sing and a rap, and also at the events we play different games, icebreakers. We create an exciting environment, and then we deliver this message in a very fun and exciting way.
Talking to Dr. Jasmine Zapata of Madison about her Beyond Beautiful project. So you're just giving us a sense of what happens at these Beyond Beautiful events.
Yes.
What do you hear from people after? What kind of response do you get?
We are getting some amazing, amazing feedback, especially from the parents, because something unique about our programs is that it's not just for the young girls that come. We invite their parents to come as well. So while we're doing breakout sessions with the girls, we have a real talk. It's not a real talk, but more like a empowerment and support group session with the parents that are there. And we're hearing a lot of great feedback. So not only do the girls feel empowered, but the parents come away with strategies of how they can better support their kids.
Yeah, I imagine there's a lot of things we might do as parents that unwittingly, unintentionally contribute to the problem, like how we talk about, you look beautiful or whatever. How do we do that in ways that don't reinforce all the bad stuff?
Yeah, I think one of the things is just focusing on, again, those inner strengths. That's the biggest message, talking about the things that you have inside that truly make you beautiful. So even having real conversations with your kids about even your own flaws. A lot of times parents, and I'm myself guilty, we give a portrayal that we're perfect and we do everything right, and teaching the kids this is what you should do. But even when you make mistakes, being transparent and telling them what's going on and lessons that they can learn. One of the biggest things we talk about is resilience. When adverse childhood experiences happen or hard things in life happen, instead of giving up, being able to get back up and keep going. And that's resilience. And that's something that makes you beyond beautiful.
Let's talk more about what's at stake. And you started to touch on this. You mentioned that for some kids, this is going to lead to depression, even thoughts of suicide. Can you talk more about what's at stake when it comes to physical and mental health?
Yes. Whew. I'll never forget the time when I was going through my pediatric training, when there was a young girl that flew in via the helicopter that brings critically ill patients in. She was a young child and attempted to hang herself, and they found her right before she died, and they brought her in. And I remember I was in the ICU putting in orders and being a part of the team. I was in training at the time, but I was a part of the team helping to revive her. And at that moment, I thought to myself, being a doctor is not enough. This is too late. I'm having contact with her too late. What could I have done, or what are things that we can do to prevent this from happening in the first place? And so there are lives at stake. This is a very, very serious thing that we need to focus on. There's a recent reports that came out that, in fact, Black children, the rates of suicide, completed suicide, has significantly increased over the last several years. And that's something that we really need to take seriously. We need to do everything that we can to talk about this issue and give protective factors and do positive youth development strategies such as these.
So that's part of what the Beyond Beautiful events are about. Do you hear more stories from kids at these events in addition to your own family, your kids' friends who you've seen in your practice? Yes. Are you hearing stories just from kids who show up at these events?
Yes. Even to just, we have a part of our events, and we are also starting to turn this event into courses and curriculum within schools, which is awesome because it gives us a longer time to connect with the students. But one of the things that just strikes me, one of the activities we do is speak positive words of affirmation over the young girls that are there, just walking up to them, telling them, you're beautiful, you're courageous, you're smart, you're intelligent. And it's a kind of a bombardment of positivity. And every event, there's a girl that just because we tell them, when we start telling them about those positive things, just tears start to fall. And I wonder what's going on in your life where just for me to come and tell you, you're beautiful, you're courageous, don't worry about what other people think about you, I believe in you, they're just crying. There's so much going on, and it's so powerful.
And I imagine, I haven't been to these events, I imagine you see lights turn on sometimes with kids,
yes.
I bet. Can you talk about maybe the positive reactions you might get by
yes.
the end of this?
Some of the lights that turn on is, it's awesome because they've received so many messages, sometimes even from your own friends and family, negative messages from the media, just looking at statistics. And then when you have someone coming in saying the total opposite, it causes a little bit of confusion. Like, wait a minute, if this person over here told me I'm stupid, I'm going to drop out, I'm going to get pregnant before I turn 18, all these negative things. But then this group of people's telling me all this wonderful stuff about me. Somebody's not right. So sometimes it even just causes them to question and dig deeper. So that's very positive. And also, as a Black woman who has overcome many, many obstacles and am a physician, there's a lot of times where young girls that are interested in the medical field will look at me and say, oh, wow, I want to be a doctor, too. And it just gives them a realization that they can reach any dream that they set their mind to.
You're working mostly directly with kids and their families, mm-hmm. as you mentioned. Do you have thoughts for the media, us in the media, how we can present beauty and also represent people like, as you say, a woman of color who's a
yes.
doctor? Like, how can we paint a better picture of the world for these kids?
Oh, you're going to have to invite me on for longer than this quick segment here. But that's an excellent question. Just to be inclusive in even the music that we listen to that plays on the radio, the CDs that sell. Well, people don't buy CDs anymore. I'm aging myself a little bit. But the records that sell and get playtime, think about the majority of the messages that are in there. What messages are those sending to young people who are listening? If the way that you can be popular and the way that you can be successful is music like this or the images that they're sending, that's a horrible message that it's sending to the young people. So I think one thing that people in media can do is insert positivity into that array of messages. Invite guests to talk about stuff like this. Play music that has a positive message. And that's just some of the things that we could do.
In our last few moments,
yes.
If there are girls or young women listening themselves or with their
yes.
parents, leave them with a quick message.
Yes, I'm going to leave you with the Beyond Beautiful Declaration. Right here in my book, and this is what everything is based off of. Today will be a great day. I'll achieve all I set my mind to. I cannot be stopped. I can do anything I want to because I'm beyond beautiful. I'm beyond beautiful. I'm courageous. I'm resilient. I'm confident. I'm creative. I am talented, intelligent, unique, and innovative. I'm worth it. I deserve it. I am treasured. I am loved. And I deserve every blessing that is coming from above. That's something that I want you to say to yourself every single day when the world talks about you or it feels like so much negativity is coming at you. You have the power to speak life over yourself. And the words you speak are so powerful. So say that about yourself. Every day. Doesn't matter what people say on the outside, your true beauty is within.
Dr. Zapata, thanks so much for joining us in the
yes.
studio.
All right. Thanks for having me, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this important topic.
That's Dr. Jasmine Zapata, a Madison-based pediatrician and doctor of preventive and public health medicine. We talked to her about her empowerment movement called Beyond Beautiful that's taking her around the country to speak to young people. You can find a link to her website with a schedule of coming events at WPR.org. Coming up next, we'll talk to a sports reporter about how the Milwaukee Brewers are doing so far this season. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump defended his administration's environmental record at a press conference this week. We'll find out what he had to say during our look at the week in Washington. First, the Milwaukee Brewers are at the midseason mark. Right now, they're running a close second in their division. But with high expectations after last year, the season has been a little underwhelming, especially in the run-up to the All-Star game. J.R. Radcliffe is a sports reporter with the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He talked to Central Time producer Bill Martins about how the team's doing so far.
So the Brewers are right in the thick of things in the NL Central. That's the good news. But, you know, a lot of people were expecting more given they darn near got to the World Series last year. So what's your take on where they're at?
It's really tough to explain this because on the one hand, you do look at the standings. They're a half game out of first place behind the Chicago Cubs in the NL Central. And you look at the fact that even other teams around the NL, even if they weren't able to win the Central, the Brewers are only a half game out of a wild card spot. So in that sense, they're very much in the thick of it because there's this parity in the National League. It isn't completely unprecedented, but it's pretty rare to have it be quite this, the wealth be spread out quite this way. But you look at where they were last year, where they were 12 games up, you know, over 500 at the All-Star break, and that was with a six-game losing streak going into the All-Star break. So from that standpoint, to be only three over 500 is a little bit of a disappointment, and they've had some things go really well for them. Christian Yelich has gone really well for them. Their offseason acquisitions, Yasmani Grandal and Mike Moustakas, have been great. They've kind of discovered something with Brandon Woodruff in the starting rotation, but then a lot of other things have gone south, and so they just haven't, you know, they just haven't been able to translate that to wins. You know, right now they've given up 17 more runs than they've scored, and that's usually a really bad omen for teams.
Yeah,
that stuff usually evens out. The teams with negative run differentials almost never have winning records.
Yeah, that's crazy. So what's the difference between last year's team and this club?
Primarily, you can look at the, I think really you can look, boil it down to the way their offense is played, and their starting rotation, you know, probably has some room to grow. Their bullpen isn't as lights out as it was at points last year, but I think we also sort of misremember how, I mean, that bullpen had struggles at times last year too. They were just really good at the end of the season when it really mattered. But if you look at the offense, I think it's pretty easy to argue that Jesus Aguilar at first base and Travis Shaw at third base were their second and third most valuable offensive players last year. I mean, Lorenzo Cain was really good too, and we've seen his numbers drop off pretty badly this year, but those two guys have completely fallen off a cliff. And Travis Shaw right now opens the second half of the season at AAA in San Antonio. The team just tried everything they could to get him going, and finally felt like they couldn't use up the roster spot on him at this point. I mean, he hit 30 home runs each of the last two seasons and simply hasn't been able to match the production, home run wise or anything. I mean, he's not getting on base.
Yeah, nobody saw that coming this year.
Yeah, it's been a massive drop off for him. And Aguilar has shown some signs. He had a really good series to close the first half against the Pirates, hit 3 home runs in 3 games.
Yeah.
But he also just hasn't been anywhere near the production of last year. And to lose two of your top offensive guys and throw Lorenzo Cain in there as well, who's fine but hasn't been what he was last year when he was getting on base almost 40% of the time.
Right.
That's a really big hit to lose three premier offensive players like that.
So they've hit the skids going into the All-Star break, going, I think, 8-15 over their last 23 games. What's the problem?
Yeah, it's hard to put the finger on exactly what. They've lost a lot of close games, and that's usually indicative of a bad bullpen, but I honestly don't think that's the problem with them. I think their bullpen is actually probably the strength of the team at this point. They just cannot get into a groove. Their starting pitchers did pick it up late toward the end there of this streak that they're on, but when the starting pitching is going good, the offense isn't clicking, and vice versa. When the offense gets six to eight runs, the starting pitching seems to just be really struggling to hold teams in check. So right now, it's kind of just one of those everything is going wrong situations. I don't really think this team is just a 300 team. I do think they have the talent to be certainly be a playoff contender throughout the rest of the season, but I do think we've seen enough through this stretch in particular, because this stretch has not been against the best teams in baseball. They played a lot of last place teams in June and did not take advantage of that. So this was a part of the schedule where they were really supposed to make hay, and they didn't. It doesn't mean that they can't really bounce back and have a strong second half against some better competition, but to me it is worrisome enough that you have to wonder if this team is capable of getting to the postseason. You look at the standings, though, and you know right now they can't. I mean, that's just the way it's set up for them. They absolutely can.
We're talking with J.R. Radcliffe, sports reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, getting an update on the Milwaukee Brewers season at this halfway point. So you talked about a couple of things that are going well. You mentioned Christian Yelich. What else is going well for them? You said the bullpen, too.
Yeah, oddly enough, it's weird to think the offense is struggling when you've got three bona fide all-stars in that lineup. I mean, Mike Moustakas is a guy who has not been able to find probably what he's worth on the open market and free agency now in back-to-back years, and the Brewers have brought him back. The Brewers did bring him back on a one-year deal. He was a very late signing. He just couldn't get the offers he wanted anywhere else. Came back to Milwaukee. They traded for him midseason last year, and he's been fantastic. He played second base for them when Travis Shaw was over at third. He's back at third now, but he can play either spot. He's got 25 home runs. He's been an absolute, I mean, maybe not a revelation, but he's been, I think, much better than people anticipated. And Yasmani Grandal, the other guy that they signed in the offseason to a significant one-year contract, but not a lengthy one, because again, he wasn't getting the multi-year offers that he anticipated. So they signed him for a little over $18 million for 1 year, and he's delivered every penny. He's the best catcher in the National League. That's, I guess, Wilson Contreras probably is the best catcher, but he's definitely in that conversation. He's number two if he's not number one. And has been as good as any catcher in baseball really since 2016. He's a guy that I think a lot of people don't realize around baseball is as good as he is. And he's been very good this year. He's got 19 home runs. I think he leads all catchers in that department. But he's a solid guy. He gets on base. He was batting leadoff for them at some point. So they've had three bona fide, you know, stars on offense.
The trade deadline is 3 weeks from today. Do you see the Brewers, who are in a win-now mode, making any big moves?
I don't know about big, because I just don't know what they have to offer. They definitely will be active at the trade deadline. We saw that last year. They were super active. The difference in 2019 is the way the trade deadline has changed. It's still July 31st is the big deadline where teams are going to make big blockbuster moves. In past years, there's been a second deadline a month later, August 31st, where you could get players, sort of, I guess, lesser known players in general, guys who had passed through waivers and other teams just, you know, didn't want to take a crack at. So the Brewers made big time use of that last year. They got Gio Gonzalez, Curtis Granderson, Xavier Cedeno, who contributed. They got a lot of guys right at that August deadline. That August deadline doesn't exist anymore. It's just the July one. And I think what we're going to see is either fewer trades or just more teams that feel like they still are in this race that aren't willing to sell players off. And I don't know what that means for the Brewers, but I do think that the bidding will require some pretty top flight guys and going away in exchange. And I don't know if the Brewers have that capital. There's nobody on the big league roster that I think they'd be willing to part with. They don't have a top heavy minor system. They have a lot of depth, but they don't have a lot of key pieces that they, I think, would be able to send away for a guy like a Will Smith, a reliever who played in the All-Star game, who might be on their radar, or a starter like Zach Wheeler of the Mets. I don't know if those guys are going to be available to the Brewers.
You know, as we wrap up our conversation here, what do you think is going to be the key for the Brewers in the second half of the season to get back to the playoffs and hopefully make a deep run?
They're just going to need performances from guys that did not have great first halves. They're going to need Lorenzo Cain to bounce back. He's been a little injured. Maybe he heals up a little bit and gets back to being a guy who can get on base with a .390 on base percentage. That'd be huge at the top of the lineup. Jesus Aguilar, like I said, sort of maybe rebounded a little bit at the end of the first half. If he can get back to being a power threat, that's a huge asset to the Brewers, especially against left-handed pitchers. They've really struggled against lefties. Eric Thames has played a lot at first base in Aguilar's stead against righties, and he's had actually a really good year, but it'd be really nice to have Aguilar at full speed. Maybe Travis Shaw comes back up and can deliver, and Mike Moustakas can go back to second, although that might infuriate Brewers fans because that might not make room for their top prospect, Keston Hiura, who
exactly
has been up with the big league team. But those guys and the starters to a degree as well, you're going to need those guys to simply bounce back, because I don't think they're going to get some savior flying in, parachuting in from another organization. I don't know who's available, like I said, in their price range. So I think it's just a matter of the guys that they relied on last year becoming those guys again.
JR, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, thanks. Let's do it again sometime. I love it.
That was JR Radcliffe, sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked to Central Time producer Bill Martins about how the Milwaukee Brewers are doing so far this season at the halfway point. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the political calculations that President Trump may be making as he fights for a citizenship question on the U.S. Census, even after a partial rejection by the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a national Latino convention kicks off today in Milwaukee. A number of presidential candidates will be in attendance. We'll look at the big issues on the table. First, we take our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. President Trump defended his environmental policies at a special address this week. The Secretary of Labor is under scrutiny for a plea deal he struck with a serial sexual predator during his time as a prosecutor. And the president is continuing to fight for a citizenship question on the 2020 census, despite a Supreme Court ruling against it. Our question for you this week, what do you think of the president continuing to push for this citizenship question on next year's census? Should he put it to rest? If you're a supporter of the president, do you see this as a distraction, or does this reinforce why you support him? What do you think about his willingness to go against his own cabinet officials on this one? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Tolu Olorunipa is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, I want to start off giving a listen to President Trump. He gave an address talking about his administration's environmental record. Here's a bit of his opening remarks.
For years, politicians told Americans that a strong economy and a vibrant energy sector were incompatible with a healthy environment. In other words, one thing doesn't go with the other, and that's wrong, because we're proving the exact opposite. A strong economy is vital to maintaining a healthy environment.
DeLue, what did the president say in making the case for his environmental performance as president?
Well, the president was trying to make the case that his administration has not been hostile to the environment or to environmental activists who make that claim and say that this administration has been rolling back all kinds of regulations that were aimed at protecting the environment. The president is saying that, yes, he has rolled back various regulations, but at the same time, he says that, you know, carbon emissions have continued to go down and that, you know, the water quality and the air quality in the country continues to be good. He's basically making the claim that his administration has been able to boost the economy while also protecting the environment. It's something that is strenuously opposed and disagreed with by activists who believe that this administration has been very dangerous for the environment. But the president wanted to make the case that he believes that his administration is balancing both boosting the economy while also protecting the environment and protecting the water and the air that all of us use.
This is not attached, apparently, to any kind of legislation or initiatives out there. Why this issue and why now for the president?
At this point in this administration, you cannot divorce anything that the president is doing from politics and from his reelection. And there was a sense internally within the president's campaign that he needed to do something to reach out to suburban women, moderate voters who care about the environment, and show that he hasn't been, you know, this wrecking ball to the environment and to environmental regulations that protect the environment. So there's a lot of reporting that shows that the president is aware that he has some ground to make up with suburban voters, suburban women in particular. And this was one example of the president sort of using an official event at the White House to speak directly to some of those voters who are concerned that some of his policies are a little bit too extreme, and show that he's not an extremist when it comes to sort of rolling back environmental protections, but that he can speak to their issues and speak to the issues that they're dealing with while also showing that he can continue to boast about a strong economy while balancing strong environmental policies as well.
Some of the reporting on this points out that climate change emissions have gone up in the United States, again, in the last couple of years. That may not be all, of course, because of anything coming from the White House. But does the president have some, I guess, reality and science problems as he makes this pitch?
He definitely does. This is a president who has said that wind turbines cause cancer. He's talked about climate change as a hoax. So both the White House and various advisors and aides to the president and members of his cabinet have had trouble defending the president's comments in the past and his focus in the past by trying to show that, you know, not only does the president not believe that climate change is a hoax, but that the president is taking actions to clean up the environment. So there are some numbers and some facts and figures that don't line up with the president's claims, including his claim that the U.S. has the cleanest air and the cleanest water in the world. It's something he claims very regularly that does not stand up to scrutiny. But it's something the president continues to say because he is much more focused on the headline and much more focused on getting across a message that he is not an extremist on environmental issues, but that he is continuing to uphold the strong environmental policies that previous presidents have. We even heard from his administration that, you know, they're taking credit in some ways for the reduction in emissions going back to the 1970s. And they say that, you know, now we're much lower than we were in the 70s. And that is not necessarily taking into account just what happened in the last couple of years, where we have seen some of that progress stalled or rolled back, but taking credit for what's happened in the last 40 years under previous presidents as well.
Talking to Tolu Olorunipa from the Washington Post, looking at some of the big news in national politics. Turning now to the citizenship question on the U.S. Census. You can weigh in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. So we saw, Tolu, the U.S. Supreme Court reject this citizenship question, saying they didn't buy the White House arguments, didn't completely shut the door on it. But then we heard the Departments of Commerce and Justice saying, okay, we're giving up on this. It's going to the printer. It's done. And then what from the president?
And then a tweet. And so many of our stories begin that way. And then the president tweeted. The president tweeted last week that the fight was not over, that he was continuing to push for getting this question about citizenship on the census, that he was basically overruling his top government Department of Justice lawyers and members of the Department of Commerce who had said that they were basically throwing in the towel. The president was saying that this question is too important. We're going to continue the fight. And that led to the Justice Department rushing back into the court saying, you know, what we said previously was no longer the case, that the president is pushing us to try to find some rationale for why we can put the citizenship question on the census, even though the court said the previous rationale was contrived and was not appropriate. The Justice Department is now looking for a new way to explain why they need to have the citizenship question on the census. That's led to an effort by the Justice Department to bring in a whole new team of lawyers. The judge basically rejected that effort, saying that time is of the essence. You can't bring in a whole new team of lawyers in this case that is basically, you know, past its deadline. The Justice Department had previously said that they had to start printing the census. They had to have a resolution by the end of June or else they wouldn't be able to make their deadline for the census. We're far beyond that now, and it's not clear what the argument is from the Justice Department as to why they need to have this question on this on the census and how they're going to go about making this case to a judge. So President Trump definitely threw a wrench in the argument and made things much more difficult for his administration. But he has shown that he is going to continue this fight as long as possible.
You wrote, Tolu, about the political angle on this legal argument and the president's motivations in keeping this fight going, even if he doesn't ultimately win. What kind of things are you looking at?
Yeah, this is a president who, according to one of his biographers, would be much more willing to lose in a dramatic tear down of a fight versus losing quietly and being seen as someone who's throwing in the towel prematurely. So a lot of this is politics and the president wanting to show his base, wanting to show his voters that he is going to the mat and not giving in, not giving into the swamp or to the career Justice Department lawyers who would be much more willing to kind of take their ball and go home and say, you know, the judge has spoken. This is the president that says, you know, we're going to exhaust all of our opportunities, any angle that we might have, even if it means an executive order that defies the Supreme Court. We're willing to go to the mat. And members of his base give him credit for that, that he is a different type of politician, that he doesn't take no for an answer, that he's willing to fight when others would be more willing to throw in the towel. And the president and some of his allies believe that he gets some benefit from that. Even if he loses in court, even if a judge strikes him down, he can say, this is just a rigged system and I'm fighting hard for your interest against the rigged system that is, you know, arrayed against you. So that's sort of the political angle that the president is viewing this through. And we've seen him take on losing fights before where the courts have struck him down over and over again, but he still tries to get some political benefit from saying that he's willing to fight and not give in, even though the odds are very much stacked against him, as they are in this case.
It appeals to his base, as you say, and it seems like it might not really cost the president anything. This isn't something that's necessarily going to turn off, say, moderate Republican voters.
Yeah, and that remains to be seen in terms of how hard the president chooses to fight this. There aren't that many voters outside of the president's base that are following this very closely or that would vote based on the census issue. It's not really a top issue for voters. Now, if we do get to a point where there's a constitutional crisis and the president is defying the Supreme Court and it looks like our government is in chaos, that is something that could turn off some moderate voters, some people who just want the census to go off without a hitch as it has happened in the past. So it remains to be seen what types of red lines the president would be willing to cross here. But I think you're right that there aren't very many voters that are going to turn away from the president or that are going to choose to vote against the president based on this issue. And it just really remains to be seen how hard the president is going to fight and whether or not if he pushes things too far and we do end up in some sort of constitutional clash, that then, you know, this becomes much more of a top of mind issue for voters who may say this is a little bit too far from what we want a president to be doing with his power.
Tolu Olorunipa is with us from The Washington Post for our weekly look at national politics. Coming up, we're going to look at a court ruling saying the president shouldn't be able to block followers on Twitter and other social media, even if they disagree with them, this could have implications for other public officials as well. What do you think? Should a person sitting in office on their personal account, if they talk about politics, if they make announcements on their personal feed, should they have the ability to block followers? Does that violate people's ability to participate in the workings of their government? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up our Week in Washington conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Tolu Olorunipa is with us, White House reporter for The Washington Post. We're looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Development on a story today, Tolu, this ongoing case of Jeffrey Epstein, this multimillion dollar hedge fund manager, apparently facing new charges of sex trafficking involving dozens of underage girls. He'd made a plea years ago in a Florida case. Now, a prosecutor there, Alex Acosta, now Secretary of Labor. A lot of questions being raised for his treatment of that 2008 case. Complicated story. Can you explain what has people asking questions about the deal and some Democrats saying Acosta should go?
Yes, Acosta just held a 53-minute press conference where he answered a lot of questions from reporters about the controversy surrounding this case. This was a case that he was involved with when he was the U.S. attorney down in Florida back in 2007 and 2008, and he basically executed a non-prosecution agreement with Jeffrey Epstein, which allowed Epstein to more or less get a pretty lenient sentence. He stayed in jail for about 13 months. He was let out on work release for a good chunk of that time, and he was only charged or only had to plead guilty to one charge of prostitution, soliciting a prostitute, when the evidence showed that he was involved in what was basically sex trafficking of underage girls. Dozens of young girls who were teenagers were basically trafficked by him and by some of his associates, and there's now a new set of indictments several years later after some investigative reporting out of New York that indicates that some of the conduct that he was engaged in back in the early 2000s is actually conduct that should be charged at a much higher level. So now Epstein is facing charges that are that could lead him to spend the rest of his life in jail. And there are a lot of critics of Acosta who say that he should have pursued these types of charges back in 2008. Acosta says that that was not possible, that the times were different, and that he did not feel as confident in the evidence and that he had back then. He said that new evidence has since come to light out of New York, and that he is happy that this this man is being charged, but that he does not regret the way that he handled the situation back in 2008. And now that he is a member of President Trump's cabinet, there's a lot of pressure on the White House, on the administration, to do something about Acosta. And one wrinkle in this case is that not only did Acosta negotiate this pretty lenient sentence, but he also kept the details from the victims, the young girls who were pleading to him and to the Justice Department for justice. They were left out of the process. They were not informed, and even a judge this year has said that decision to not inform these victims was out of step with the law, that Acosta and his associates broke the law by not informing the victims about this non-prosecution agreement. So this is a pretty big controversy now that Epstein has been arrested and is being charged with pretty serious crimes of, trafficking dozens of underage girls. And Acosta is on the hot seat now because he was someone who was very intimately involved in the non-prosecution agreement that allowed Epstein to get off with what many believe to be a far too lenient sentence that only kept him in jail for a little more than a year.
We'll follow more of this story. We're working on getting the Miami Herald reporter who had followed a lot of this on the show. Maybe watch for that next week. Right now, it's our weekly roundup of national news. Tolu Olorunipa is with us from The Washington Post. Turning to this court ruling, Tolu, on President Trump's critics on Twitter, some people who he had blocked as followers had sued and won in a federal appeals court this week. I want to start us off here with a caller and go to Max in Two Rivers with his reaction. Max, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think it's his own account. Although he posts stuff about, you know, political issues and whatnot, I think he still has the right to block somebody just like anyone else does. The president is no different than the average person. It's just a job. But I think it's not so much when he blocks somebody, it's not him rejecting people in a political discussion. I feel like most of the time it's people trying to troll him and mess with them.
Max, thanks a lot for the call. And to Max, hitting on some of the key points in the legal case here, right? What kind of things can a public official do on their Twitter feed? And when does it cross the line into becoming, in effect, their government actions on that Twitter feed?
Yeah, this is new territory for the legal system to jump into in terms of, you know, the privacy that politicians are able to have. Social media is definitely a different set of rules that they have to follow. Now, the First Amendment basically gives the public the right to know what politicians and public officials are doing in terms of government purposes on social media. And the judges in this case basically said that by blocking people from his Twitter account, President Trump is blocking them from the public square. This is a Twitter account that the president has used to make news, to announce new policies, to give announcements that the public could use, even to give warnings to people who may be in harm's way for natural disasters. So the judge basically said, this is a public forum, and it's not in keeping with the First Amendment to block individual people from being able to access the information on this account. It is definitely a new area for the courts to weigh in, and there are some privacy concerns here. But it is, you know, as a reporter or someone who, you know, relies on the First Amendment, there is a clear sense from the First Amendment that government officials should not be restricting the access of the public to publicly available information that it could be used, that they could use to, you know, help themselves or to be aware of what the government is doing. So for government accounts, there are very strict rules about what can be done on social media. And in this case, the courts are saying that those rules apply even to the president, even on an account that was, you know, previously a private account, but now is used as the main account for the president of the United States. And it remains to be seen whether President Trump complies with this ruling and decides to unblock all of these people, or if he seeks other legal recourses. But it is a very interesting ruling, and it could have reverberations for future politicians, future presidents, and other public officials as well.
Time for one call. Thanks, Max. We'll go now to Yordis in Colfax. Yordis, hi.
Hi. I have a general comment about Trump, and when you say that he's a different kind of politician, I would argue that he's really a dictatorship in the making. He's testing every rule, every ethic, every principle in this country, and he is pushing the limits. And this is maybe appealing to this cult-like following he has, but it's traumatic to people that are compassionate thinking people that really try to follow the rules and appreciate democracy and all its fullness and complexity. I'm really disturbed when people act like this is, he's not a normal politician, as if this is some great new thing.
Yordis, thanks for calling in. Yordis concerned to Lou that this is just, this Twitter issue is one more example of what she sees as a consistent theme of bending the rules by the president, briefly.
Yes, there are many instances of the president bending rules and trying to push norms and breaking norms and pushing boundaries, and it really will remain to be seen how the public responds. We did see a lot of members of the public vote against that type of behavior in 2018 in the midterms, voting for Democrats instead to try to rein him in. 2020 looms, and there's a chance that the president could face a backlash for causing so much chaos and causing so much constitutional concerns about whether or not he is withholding or upholding the rules and norms of his office, and voters will have the ultimate say.
Yordis, thanks for the call. In our last 30 seconds, a change in the Democratic field. Congressman Eric Swalwell out, billionaire Tom Steyer in. Does anything really change with that, Tolu, in our last 30 seconds?
Well, I'm not sure that much will change because both of those candidates are polling pretty low. There aren't many changes when it comes to the top of the field, the top five candidates who have been getting all of the traction and the attention. One thing about Tom Steyer is that he does have a lot of money, and if he decides to deploy all of that for his campaign, it could shake things up a little bit, but he has not been able to gain a lot of traction so far, and he's been more or less campaigning for the better part of the last year.
Tolu, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Tolu Olorunipa is a White House reporter at The Washington Post. He's with us for our weekly check-in on the top stories in the nation's capital. Still time for you to weigh in on this court ruling on the president and his Twitter feed, saying even in his personal feed, because he uses it a lot for public business, he's not allowed, the court says, to block people. What do you think about this? You can tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know what you think. And you can always email ideas@WPR.org. What should be the rules for social media use by not just the president, but any politician? Wisconsin just got 16,000 square miles bigger, according to a map that's generating controversy online. A map published by the noted cartographers at Mountain Dew, captioned the Dew United States, shows each state colored in with a rad pattern. It's part of a campaign with special bottles for each state. But here's where it all went wrong, or right, depending on how you look at it. On the map, Wisconsin includes Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Let that sink in a minute. The map was shared on Twitter with hilarious results. The Twitter account titled The Upper Peninsula got things rolling. Quote, "Dear Mountain Dew, I am not Wisconsin. Fix this or send a free case to my residence." A few minutes later, "Fix this and send a free case to my residence." One Wisconsin parent was happy that their student at Michigan Tech in Houghton would now pay in-state tuition. A number of Michiganders pointed out that traditional Michigan soda brands like Faygo and Werner's would never make that kind of mistake. And the Faygo company itself joined in. Quote, "You're by far our favorite peninsula as representatives of the population. We'd never make that mistake." In a lot of Michigan, they call soda pop. A Wisconsinite named Thomas joined the action. "While you are not Wisconsin, you should be, would be better off as, and we would welcome you with ginseng, cranberry, brandy-filled arms." Wisconsin's tourism department joined in too, simply saying, "New state lines, who dis?" This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.